Listening Dog Media.
DJ. Hello, I'm Chris Hawkins, and this is How to DJ.
How to DJ.
Equipment was pretty basic. Do you know what I mean? And so to be able to mix two records on those was quite an achievement, especially chewing your face off.
They told me the DJ was sick. And what I fell in for him, and I got paid £15. And I was like, oh my God, like £15?
DJing is a live environment. It's happening here and now.
A podcast exploring life stories, techniques, minds, and experiences of much-loved DJs, where I ask them to pick five questions from a box of 45. And for this episode, one of the UK's best scratch DJs.
And I remember getting really frustrated with one of my records and kind of like churning the needle across.
An award winner.
It's like, oh my God, we've won it. We've actually won it.
A pioneer.
Scratching, I don't think anything has made that easier because it's still what it is. There isn't a software or a plugin that can kind of replicate that human aspect of it.
DJ Prime Cuts, aka Joel Clements from Scratch Perverts. Welcome to How to DJ.
Hello, thank you for having me.
When, Joel, was your first scratch?
I used to have a 45 of Malcolm McLaren Buffalo Girls, and I had an Amstrad stack system, and it had this kind of tone arm that tracked. You couldn't like pick it up. You have to track it and then drop the needle down. And I remember the intro to that. It's like, boom, boom, wah. And on the wah, I used to go, wah, 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 wah.
How old were you?
I'd have been, what, 12 at that time.
You know what I want to know is, why did you do that?
Well, one of my friends at school, his older brother came to pick him up and I was doing it and he freaked out. And I thought, this is a way of getting some respect from the older boys.
Well, so a disruptor age 12.
So it was just an immediate thing. And I mean, it's not the easiest thing to start scratching on. So I didn't really kind of properly pursue it until maybe a year or two later.
I don't fully get what it was. What was it? An Amstrad? What, stack? What?
You know, they used to have these kind of like stack stereo systems which have a tape cassette, amplifier, radio, and on the top of it would be a turntable.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And it was silver and, you know, You'd buy it from kind of like a department store.
Yeah.
And it was like that was what everybody had when they were a kid. And that was my first, you know, way of actually taking the record and cutting it. But it was completely, you know, Neanderthal, really. You know, it's just, and I remember getting really frustrated with one of my records and kind of like churning the needle across. And I've still got that record. It's Play That Beat, Mr. DJ, and I got so frustrated with it. But about a year later, I bought like a hi-fi system, and I actually started properly scratching on that. Even though it was a belt drive record player, I actually was, you know, learning to use the volume knob to cut the sound in and out. So it wasn't like a crossfader on a mixer. It was actually a dial. But I'd be able to go, bring the sound in and out with the dial.
But just one turntable?
One turntable, yeah. And that was where the sort of obsessed, that's when I started to get really obsessed with it.
I was just going to say, is obsessed the word? Yeah.
yes. It was like my own little world that I'd created. There was no one else doing it. None of my friends were doing it. And it was a kind of like thing that I just did for myself for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then my nan really kindly bought me a pair of turntables for my 16th birthday. And that was when things really kind of took off.
Wow. So you got your nan to thank for your career.
Yes, I have. Thank you, nan. Thank you so much.
So what difference did that make to your life?
Well, it was a huge change because, you know, one minute you're on this is a naff kind of hi-fi thing for cutting. And then you've actually got the real thing. You know, it was a big jump. And having two meant that you could start, you know, going from deck to deck, you know, making drum breaks go longer, and then friends of mine would come around and MC. So I'd have rappers turning up all the time, and then, you know, just continue to learn the different scratches and try to get better and better and better.
Who were these guys?
There was a guy called Martin Gaspard and Anthony Sylvester, who was King MRG. He was from Stratford. And Anthony Sylvester was Kissy K, who I'm still really good friends with these guys. He's from Plastow. And a guy called Chris Allender. I forget Chris's MC name. But we were just kids. We were just kids being stupid. But it was an amazing time. And for me, you know, it was not, there was no pathway to anything. This, we just did it for fun.
In your bedroom?
Yeah. It wasn't like there was any kind of, you know, we were just kids having fun with it. And being a fan of hip hop, it was like you had to be a participant. If you took it seriously, you had to participate in it. It wasn't like you just sort of looked from the sidelines. You had to take on an element of the culture. And that was what, that was what the DJ represented to me.
Had you done your 10,000 hours then in your bedroom before you even played out?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
then some.
Yeah. Just a man staring at a wall for 10,000 hours. Yes. And it wasn't like it was there was no vision or one day I could do this as a profession. It was like, I'm just doing this because I love doing it.
Well, how did it turn into a profession?
Well, that was a deliberate move. I got myself sacked from, I was working as an editor in Soho on Dean Street. It was actually on Med Street, in between Dean Street, and there was like a post-production house. I was working there, and because I was around all the record shops, sort of got friendly with Tony and the rest of the guys and the Scratch Perverts, and when they formed the crew, because I was still sort of, you know, I'd just been promoted, I was kind of doing well in the job, and I was a bit of an egotistical prick, I sort of said, no, I don't want to be in the gang. I'm above this.
Wow, brave.
But as time went on...
Brave or stupid?
Both. but as time went on and I became more friendly with Tone and, you know, saw what the guys was doing was really exciting. And I thought, yeah, I'll get involved in this. And then at the end of 97, made the decision to get sacked so I could sign on. So I had to get Paul to sack me, which was not an easy task because he just promoted me and he was very reluctant. So I had to kind of try and devise these ways of getting sacked on the spot, turning up late. And he was reprimanding me and I asked for a pay rise and that did the job.
Scratch Perverts existed then?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were one of the founders.
Yeah, it says that on Wikipedia. I mean...
It wasn't from Wikipedia. I'm not that lazy. Thanks, though.
It says me, Tony, and Renegade. But, really, the first people to put it together... I mean, it's Tony's idea to put the crew together. And First Rate and Mr. Thing were kind of out there gigging. Like, they were gigging regularly at that time. They were in clubs all the time. And they sort of flew the flag of the crew first. Then Tony won the ITFs in New York. And then the crew kind of got ready to battle in Amsterdam. We faced the Beat Junkies in the world finals of the ITF. And that was a big, big turning point. You know, being on stage battling, for me, were my idols at the time. Babu, J-Rock, Rheumatic and Melody, who an outfit from Los Angeles. So that was when things sort of started to get quite serious when we got ourselves into. I mean, that was the reason we put the crew together, was to try and battle and win some competitions. Right. But that was when it really took off. It was 98.
Where did the name come from? Do I want to know?
I think Theo, Fake Blood. Theo came up with the name some years before. Yeah, I mean, it's when, you know, you had Scratch Pickles and all these sort of like daft names. So it was a kind of, at the time, it was in vogue to kind of name yourself something like that. Now I'm in my 50s. It doesn't quite have the same ring to it.
Those DMC championships. What year did you first win as a team?
Oh, it was a team. We actually won the first time they did a team competition in 99. So that was in New York at the Hammerstein Ballroom. So it was the first year they did a team, like an actual team-based competition. And, yeah, we qualified at Subterranea. And then we kind of made the battle between us and the Allies. And we kind of called them out and we did a load of diss stuff against A-Track and Craze. And the guys in New York loved it.
How important was it for you to win?
I mean... If for every win, there's two or three losses. I think we were just fortunate that our approach to that battle was one of, you know, calling them out. We were dissing them hard, and that worked. It may not have worked a year later in a different venue or a different city, but it worked in New York. And it was, we didn't think we'd won it. They actually made us wait till the following day to announce it. And we were all on stage and they're saying, and in second place, and we're all looking at one another thinking, here we go, they're going to say Scratch Perverts, and they say the Allies. It's like, oh my God, we've won it. We've actually won it. And then we defended the following year, and then the following year after that, we formed a sort of international super crew with Craze and Infamous and did the Perverted Allies.
And won it again?
Yes. Yeah.
Did those two wins, do you think they changed your life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, The UK DMC victory was a big change because it kind of put myself on the map as an individual, and it afforded me the ability to go out and DJ a lot in clubs and earn a living whilst also preparing for the battles. So while we were doing the DJ battle thing, we were all, you know, I'd been playing in clubs since I was a teenager, so I was quite into that side of DJing as well as the sort of turntable centric stuff. I was into buying, you know, digging for tunes and playing in a club.
So you were like, if you like, a regular DJ.
Some of the first gigs I ever did were on the same bill as Norman, and Nicky Holloway, Pete Tong, Paul Oakenfold. There's two guys from my hometown, Craig and Marcus, used to put these nights on at the Red Lion, which was a spot that used to, was a kind of real kind of hot pot of DJ talent at the time, people really cutting their teeth. And I was just very fortunate to be on the same stage as those dudes when I was 17.
What was that place like?
Incredible. They had a sound system from, I think, the Odeon in Leicester Square. So it was like a massive sound. And it's a boozer with a venue next door to it. So you've just got this kind of like shed next door to a pub. And it was just sort of, you know, spit and sawdust kind of place.
How big?
400 people.
Well, how are they getting those huge names though?
They weren't huge though at the time.
Okay.
You know, this is, we're talking 88, 89, 90, 91, that sort of period of time.
But you still sort of knew who they were and were like honoured to be on the same bill as
them. Oh, big time. I mean, it was less, there was less sort of DJ as the star kind of back then. It was more about the music and the music that people like Norman were championing, you know, the Rare Groove thing and then more, you know, moving more into sort of house music as well. It was more about that, you know, that was what you represented rather than your name. So it was, you know, the music was kind of at the forefront and you wouldn't be in the venue looking up at whoever was on stage DJing. You'd just be getting down and
so
dancing.
Were you having to make a decision about which road you were going to go down?
No, because I was working, you know, I was working I was doing an apprenticeship and I was, you know, going to work in a terrible, terrible factory for like 5-6 years at that time. So it wasn't like this is it. None of it was an option. It's like you go to work, you earn some money to buy some tunes that you can play in a night, you know, a given night. And that was it. And you get 40 quid for the gig. So it was sort of, you know, almost bus fare money. But I was very lucky that that venue was not far from where my mum lived.
What a way to cut your teeth.
Yeah, I was really lucky. Really lucky. And I just enjoy going out at that time. So if I wasn't DJing, I'd be out at a club, you know, with my friends.
Early noughties then. Scratch perverts all over everywhere.
Well, that eventually, this period of time I'm talking about is late 80s, early 90s. It's a long time before, you know, we got together in the sort of late 90s. And then, you know, we really rode a crest of interest in the whole turntable thing.
That's very modest interest.
Yeah.
Because it was a massive deal.
As it happened, it was all sort of, it all just sort of went into fast forward. So much was happening in such a tiny amount of time. I looked for it because I've got my gig diaries all the way back to 99. And I did a little interview thing for Fabric about a year ago. And I was saying to my missus, I'm going to go through all the gigs and see how many times I played the club. And going through, you know, the diaries, you realise, you know, Fabric opens October 99. And then we're doing the DMC's finals like within weeks of this, and then some other huge thing, then supporting Fatboy Slim in New York, and then doing this, and then doing it's just all with, you think, how did we have the time to get ready for any of this? But it was just, you know, it was just happening, and we were kind of, you know, mad young and keen, and there were so many things all kind of like driving together at once, with all these new techniques and new ways of doing things with DJing, new forms of music coming through. Yeah, you know, the hip hop scene in the UK was really healthy at that time as well. So it was everything just sort of came together.
Your residency at Fabric is legendary. Do you remember your very first night there?
Yes, yeah, it was me and First Rate. Like I say, it was October. They opened over 2 weekends, and we played the second weekend. And because we were gigging, you know, we were gigging so much at that time, it was like DJing at another London nightclub. I didn't see it as like, this is the beginning of some new era in Clubland. It was a brand new place, you know, a brand new spot. And then over the coming months, we kind of worked there semi-regular. And then we sat down with the guys who were running it at the time, early 2000. And they were saying, we want you to be like residents. And we played there every month for 15 years. 160 times I've played there.
Has anyone done it more?
Oh, I'm sure Craig and Terry have played there more. But other than those two, I wouldn't have thought there's many that have played that many times. On a Friday night, yeah. I wouldn't have thought. On a Friday night, yeah, because that we would do Fabric Live.
That's like a big chunk of your adult life.
Yes, I'm amazed my liver is here to tell the tale.
Are they boozy nights?
Well, we would often play room one, but late. So you couldn't really get, you couldn't get hammered. You needed to be kind of complimentous, but you would, yeah. I mean, obviously we weren't particularly well behaved back then, but it was a good, it was a just a great experience. And to, you kind of learn to DJ in a very different way, being in room one and playing, you know, that kind of from three till six. Because you're trying to keep the energy going, you've got to keep everyone in the room, and you know, pre-smoking ban, you know, you were able to keep everyone in that room right until the end. It was a great time, and we, you know, befriending producers and when knowing lots of people in the drum and bass scene, and then the dubstep thing started getting popular, and I felt like I was kind of flying the flag for that form of music because I lived in the area where a lot of the producers were based. I'm in West Norwood, and a lot of the guys around Croydon, South London, and it was a beautiful time to feel like I was representing something that was so local to me, and befriending some of the producers and being able to cut dubs, and you know, we were knee deep in that stuff for a number of years, before your CDs and USBs sort of took over, and if you wanted to play something, you have to play it on a turntable, so you had to go and cut a dub plate, and there's a cutting house not far from me in Forest Hill Transitions, so that was like a regular journey going to there and with all your files and getting some dub plates cut. It was beautiful time.
How did you put together your famous Fabric Live 22 mix? Was it live mixed,
that one? I think because it's all three of us, we didn't really approach it with all of us in the room at the same time. We did each bit individually. So you can actually look at the track list and say, right, that's Joel, that's Neil, that's Tony. So I think that was the kind of running order. So the first bit's me, then I think Neil does a bit. I haven't looked at it for years.
Did you do your bit live?
I try to, yeah. I try to do as much of it. And I take that approach now, just where you kind of, even if you're just doing it in like micro sort of sets, at least the bit that you do as you record it is recorded live. And then if you need to stitch it next to, you know, to the next thing.
Did you, like when that album came out, were you feeling like everything you did, nothing could go wrong?
It did. Yeah, it was a time where, yeah, it felt like we could do no wrong. It did feel like we were, everything was just on fire. The only thing we didn't really do is capitalize by releasing a lot of music, but it was just because we were so busy,
yeah,
just DJing and doing mixes.
Were you traveling the world?
And doing an awful lot of traveling. Yeah. Yeah. So
you look very well on it. You know, what's been...
It was a long time ago.
It's been a period
I've
of recovery.
I've had quite a long time to recover.
How many times have you played Glastonbury?
Maybe 6 to 10 times. I can't remember. I know the first time we were booked, we missed it because we got stuck in traffic. And I thought, oh, well, that's the end of that then. But one of my favourite memories of DJing was we did the dance tent sort of mid-2000s. Daffid, a good friend of ours who ran Club Ufo Bach in Cardiff, he was doing the tent running order. So he put us on as the penultimate act between the Roots and the Streets. We had no right to be on that slot. And just before we started playing, the heavens opened. So the whole tent was just heaving with people. And that was just such a spectacular moment. I've still got it. I keep meaning I've got to get the tape digitized because I've got it on tape at home, and I keep meaning to do it only because I want to watch it again because Tony's hair is about this long.
Tell me what you remember about looking out on that crowd.
That's the thing. It's just the energy. It's super overwhelming when you've got that kind of, when everyone is going completely bananas. We did this thing where we got the MC to shout switch and we bash through like the biggest tunes of the time. So Anti Up, Seven Nation Army, you know, Simon Says, all these huge, huge records to see how much, you know, bedlam we could create. And we did a thing in Brazil around the same time. And we'd got this together off the back of this Brazilian gig where we played a club that had banned hip hop music for 3 years. And we went back there and took all the big tunes from when the ban happened just to see if we could create as much mayhem as possible. And I remember Marky, you know, the drummer bass DJ, he had to come out and calm the crowd down, say, no, you got to stop, someone's going to get hurt. It was that crazy.
Was the idea always to create bedlam?
Yeah, I think we just wanted energy. That was the thing. And we would, you know, we formed the crew, you know, we were battling one another at the same time as when we formed the crew. So I think we carried on that mentality of trying to outdo one another. You know, I would want to I would want to cut a dub plate that neither Neil or Tone had even heard of, and you want to be able to make the crowd go mad. And I think all of us had that kind of slightly self-centered approach that we wanted to outdo the other two. And I think that led to us being really kind of focused for a long period of time.
So is Scratch Perfect just you now?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, Tony's not really working at the moment. He's moved on to do another thing.
Where is Tony Vegas?
He's living in East London.
Okay.
Yeah. And I speak to him all the time. I'm still very, very good friends with him. You know, he's like a brother. So, we chat a lot. But we're just not DJing together at the moment. But, you know, never say never.
Sure. Oh, okay. Exciting. DJ! What do you think about DJs bringing more and more tricks and elements of scratch and turntableist DJs doing all of that in the mainstream?
Oh, I'm not sure if they do, really. I can't think of many mainstream DJs that do scratching.
Do you think it's easier than ever to do, though?
I think DJing has become more accessible. It's become more expensive, but it's become more accessible in as far as the effort that you have to put in. You can just buy your way into it and you can buy expensive equipment. You can buy a load of music. You don't actually have to, like in the past, if you wanted a particular record, you've got to go to record fair or just dig for it for 15 years in the hope that you might turn it up at some random location. So it's a demanding thing because the medium was records and that was it. There wasn't any other alternative. But now that digital stuff has crept in, it's much easier to acquire any piece of music, pretty much. So that aspect, I think, has leveled the playing field and has made it much easier for people to kind of go out and get a collection of music together that they could DJ with. And the technology has made it such that it's kind of de-skilled it to some degree, and you can link songs together using the software. You can beat match. You don't have to rely so much on corrective techniques while you're DJing. But scratching, I don't think anything has made that easier because it's still what it is. There isn't a software or a plugin that can kind of replicate that human aspect of it.
So does that mean technology hasn't changed what you do?
No, not really. It's removed some of the issues. Like one of the things because I was one of the last people on the circuit to go digital. I was still playing dub plates in 2009, 2010. But then you'd turn up and there'd be feedback. And that was the main thing that you were trying to avoid is feedback from the needle. So where the sound system feeds into it and then you can't go beyond a particular volume. And DJing on CDJs or digitally removes all of that. And now there's a piece of equipment that you can plonk on the center of the turntable and it spins and you don't even need a needle on the vinyl. You're just moving this thing forwards and backwards called phase. And that's great if you're playing at a festival where there's loads of low end. So it's removed some of the issues, and then you get another set of technical issues that can get in the way. But as far as actual scratching, no, I mean, you have to, there's no sort of faking that. You have to spend the 10,000 hours staring at a wall.
Do you like playing with the technology?
Yeah, I've always loved technology, always. I think when I first was doing the electronic engineering as the apprenticeship, and I'd just been given my turntables, I was 16, and I remember we had the guy from the kind of, one of the head honchos from the factory came and visited this site where we were like studying, and it came out that I was into DJing and turntables, and he was like, oh, have you ever felt compelled to open up the turntable and look how it works? I thought, nope. Zero interest in doing that. And now I'm an old fart. I do quite like opening up bits of equipment and trying to mend them, and that's another aspect of what I do in, you know, working in production and building a studio at home, you know, over the years, and buying vintage equipment and sometimes trying to fix it and then sell it on, and or just trying to fix it and keep it. So even though I didn't stay at the electronic engineering gig for very long, same as I didn't stay in media very long, it's still handy to have those skills of a soldering iron.
You started out DJing when DJs could just DJ, but I think that there's an increasing pressure on DJs to be producers too. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think the game is very different now. I think you can't just... Well, saying that, there are outliers. So if you look at Ben UFO, Ben UFO doesn't make tunes, but he's a very, very successful DJ.
So I'm sort of thinking that maybe you've always been a producer too.
Yeah. I mean, when I got the turntables, I would be making, you know, beat tapes with, you know, loop, basically using the turntables as a sampler. And I borrowed a four-track cassette thing. So I'd loop up the drum, and then I'd get another thing like Al Narfish, and I'd loop up the beginning of Al Narfish and layer that on top. So it'd just be these layers of loops, and trying to make a tune out of just these loop layers, you know, going back and forth on the turntables. And then beyond that, I remember buying a sampler, but unfortunately that got stolen about a month after I bought it. And then about 2 years later, coming into a little bit of money and buying a sampler again. And then that got stolen. So I didn't own any equipment for some time, but when the crew was formed and we started earning money, that was one of the first things I did, was start building a studio that I could make music in.
So you've got quite a setup at home, yeah?
Yes. You know, it's 20 years of kind of, I joke and say it's 20 years of selling crack cocaine, but it's 20 years of buying and selling equipment, and being quite fortunate really at the outset that a lot of this stuff was cheap. It wasn't expensive. You know, Jupiter 8, when I first started looking to get, this is like a polysynth. Back then when I was first starting buying equipment, they were like 900 quid. In fact, I remember passing one up for £900 because it didn't have MIDI. And I don't want that, it hasn't got MIDI. And they never did. They never had MIDI on them. So I didn't say how foolish I was. And now they're worth like £20,000.
I think there'd be a lot of people that would love to know a bit more about the studio. Can you describe the setup?
Well, it's mainly analog synths and drum machines. It's like a kind of, my friends joke and say it's like a synth blanket. So it's like all of the walls are kind of like keyboards and synths, and like a Fender Rhodes and a Prophet 5 and a Jupiter 8, that kind of stuff. And when I come to, the way I'm working at the moment, I'm building like music, like for the release I just did with Trilogy Tapes, I kind of build a table of stuff, and then sync it all together, and then just jam with it and record that into the computer. And that's the kind of hub. And I've got sort of various sequences, this thing called a Circlon, which is a beautiful piece of equipment. But it's all very hands-on. I try to make it as hands-on as possible so that it's just fun. I find just sort of working with a mouse and a laptop or a computer quite debilitating.
Fun is quite a key word, I think, because that's what you've always brought to the party, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not fun, what's the point? You know, what's the point? I don't want to slave over this thing. I want to have a laugh and enjoy it. And, you know, I think with music now and the ability, everything could just sound so perfect. What I really enjoy with the table is that you tend to make mistakes and get things wrong, or you just sort of, if you're working with this particular piece of equipment, is an SP1200, it's a very old sampler with 10 seconds of sample time. But the way in which you work with it, it kind of draws you into, you're just concentrating on rhythm and what you're doing and having fun with it. And then I locked that to an 808, which is like a vintage drum machine. And those two together, you've got to go some to fuck it up because they're just magic. It's like a magic combination and it's instant. And I think because you're not looking at anything other than these pieces of equipment and hearing, you can just lock into the groove of it and get, you know, and program things in a very different way than you would if you were staring at a big colourful screen.
And have you always enjoyed the performance element being on stage?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's why I like the table, because the table is, it's like you're performing, you're jamming with it, and you're kind of just letting the thing kind of build itself, but also it's all very hands-on. And, you know, with the DJ battling thing, that was all, you know, pure vaudeville, really, isn't it? When you look at some of the things that we were getting up to, sort of shooting planes down and stuff within a routine and calling people babies and having baby sounds. And it's, yeah, it is all just a big show.
Yeah, a lot of theatre.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the DJ battling. Like, you look at someone like, I mean, Rock Raider, God rest in peace. When you see him on the turntables, he looks like an absolute monster. Like a real nasty man who's like, and then when you meet him, he's the sweetest dude. And I love that. I love the fact that it is just all an act. And there's lots of friends that I've met through the scene, and, you know, even people that initially may have been adversaries, you know, over the years, you get to know them and realize that, you know, we all have this sort of shared love of this thing. And it is just, you know, the battle is just that. It's just the battle.
Could you ever do it again?
Oh God, no. No way. No way. Why? I actually look at it. I look at some of them. I've sort of shown my kids and I just sort of think, how the hell did I do that? How did I manage to actually pull that off? Or how did the crew manage to do this within, you know, this time frame of all this other stuff happening? But it's because, you know, we ate, slept, drank, you know, that life for quite a few years. And it was, you know, it was a long time coming for me. I first went in for DMC when I was 17. then went in for it, you know, got to a regional final, went in for it again the following year. And we're talking 1991. So, and then when I went back in for it again in 96, went in for it again in 97. So didn't win any of them, but then 98 that year, that's when it sort of paid off.
If you did go in for it again, would you win?
Oh, of course. Of course. But it's such, I think just culturally, I'm in a different place, really. I think the DJ battle thing is such a kind of specific way of playing. And, you know, to represent yourself in 6 minutes, which is often a year's worth of work, to try and represent yourself in that period of time. And if you get it wrong, it's a tough one to take. If you win, I mean, it's marvellous. But, yeah, the losing, if you get stuff wrong, we all had, in the crew, we all had this ability to kind of slightly masochistic kind of way of approaching a routine to make sure there was at least two or three bits in it where it could go completely and utterly wrong.
Have you got any old ideas that you never got to put into practice?
As far as like DJ battling?
Yeah.
I love scratching still. I still enjoy kind of like trying to break down a pattern or, you know, invent a different way of approaching something. But I don't feel like, oh, if only I'd done that, or if only I'd incorporated this. You know, I think I was just very fortunate that the timing of certain things came along just at the right time for me to be sort of armed with this new idea. You know, when we were getting ready to do the Scratch Con, we did the after show at the Fillmore West in San Francisco. It was a really famous Hendrix venue. And just in a conversation with my dad about Hendrix and feedback, in my mind, I'm thinking, feedback? Yeah, the way Jimmy used to go to the amp and make those mad sounds. I wonder if you could do that with a mixer. And the next time Tony was over, we were rehearsing, I was just talking to him as I'm talking to you now, putting the cables in, saying, look, I'm just going to try and do this like feedback. Oh, my God. And we found all these different ways of using feedback. And it was just, you know, just a conversation I'd had with my dad. And then, bang, you've got this new weapon that allowed us to do this whole routine where we took all the records off the turntables. We had De La Soul playing in the background saying, take it off, and took it all off, and then started the new thing with this mad feedback sound. And it was just from that one conversation. But it's, I've just been fortunate that all through the kind of battle career, those things just happened. You know, a friend of mine, Rob Euro, invented this thing called the Euro Scratch, and traveling to Brighton to see this new technique that he come up with. And then, you know, it was just before battle season was starting, and I had this new thing that sort of used two faders at once to do this kind of mad helicopter sound. And it was all, yeah, it all just fell into place.
It's, you get so animated talking about it.
Well, it was good. Yeah, it's good times. And yeah, I it is exciting to think about it now. Think about traveling to, you know, to Hawaii to battle A-Track. And, you know, also that feeling of how on earth did I have the bottle to do that? But it was, you know, it was magical times.
Still working hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there is no plan B. There is no plan B for me. And I've got two kids. I've got a wife and kids.
Of course, you've got a very expensive pair of sunglasses on there. So things are going all right, are they?
Yeah, I mean, with about 2 years ago, I decided to really give the social media thing a kick with Instagram, and came up with this sort of just an idea to use the mixer in a slightly different way, to just loop things up. So, and not having to rely on any other technology other than the mixer. The mixer has an echo or a delay unit inside it. And I figured a way of, you know, if you set that to maximum and you get the rhythm right, you can actually start looping up tracks infinitely. So as long as you get the timing right, you can loop it up infinitely. And then I thought, oh, I can kind of recreate a lot of kind of classic hip hop tunes doing this. So I just embarked on this whole real campaign to try and get the numbers up. And I think I managed to get it from, it's like 2,000 people a couple of years ago, and it's now like nearly 19,000. So it's worked. It's been a bit of work, you know, graft, but fun to do. But it's that having those numbers also opens up a lot of doors and opportunities for other things.
Do you still like playing out?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Best job in the world ever. And I feel it's an exciting time now to be making the music I can play in sets as well. So I feel like that is something that I should have done more, you know, when I was younger. But now it feels like I've got this particular approach that I feel like is working for me, and this tempo that I like producing music at. for that route, sort of 130 to 160 BPM, drawing a lot of influence from like Chicago and Detroit, and trying to put my own little spin on it. And it's just this, it's a joyous thing being able to play some of those things. And with social media and the turnaround of things, if it does, you know, you don't have to kind of wait for a label to release it. You can kind of get this kind of instant gratification of building something and then taking it to a dance and having it, you know, playing it straight away. I did a thing in Camden for Camden Inspire, and there's a tune I've done that sort of slows down a bit like French Kiss. And the audience, completely unprompted, started dipping down to the ground, and it was just a mad moment of like, what? They can't have known the tune. I mean, it was, you know, it's a brand new record. But yeah, it, stuff like that is lovely.
They're the moments.
Yeah.
Joel, this podcast episode's supported by in-ear specialist Flair Audio. Is there a song that you think sounds amazing with earphones in, perfect for listening to on your own?
So for headphone music, I'd have to say something produced by the Mizell brothers or Wayne Henderson, around the kind of mid-70s to late-70s period. Lots of incredible music being produced, and the kind of accumulation of like everyone being at the top of their game, the musicians, the engineers, the producers. So something by Pleasure, an outfit. They did a load of albums produced by Wayne Henderson, Bouncy Lady in 75, and then they did a track called Joyous in, I think, 77, 78. It's just incredible. It's a magical, magical sounding record. So yeah, Joyous by Pleasure.
Joel, it's time for the first of your five picks from 45 in this record box on my side here. All the questions are on 45 sleeves. I'll dip into the box. You say when, I'll pull one out. You say when?
When?
This first one is, what's the downside to being a DJ? So after a lot of positivity.
Ooh, so the downside, obviously alcoholism and drug addiction.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as enthusiastic as I am now, you know, throughout the last sort of 10 years, I think when my son was first born, there was a bit of a dip in the work, and that was a difficult time. That was a hard period because we lost our agent. We were on a really good agency, and they sort of dropped us without telling us, kind of thing. So there was a period of time where there was a lot of uncertainty just when I needed it. I needed certainty in my life, you know, having just had a kid. But, you know, you dust yourself off and carry on. So I think the downside, yeah, that's definitely a downside. If you need a team of people, you need everything to be rock solid. And obviously trying to juggle, you know, family and the music thing. But I feel like I've got that nailed. I feel like I've got a good work-life balance thing going on. And, you know, the nature of the work affords me the ability to be quite flexible.
You referred to the drinking at Fabric a little bit earlier. Did you get carried away?
Literally, yes, literally carried away. I mean, it wasn't always, you know, debauchery. I'm quite sensible, to be honest. We definitely had a lot of fun and definitely misbehaved, you know. But I think I like to wake up on a Monday morning and feel straight. I like feeling, you know, that I can get a lot done in the week. I wasn't somebody who would party from the weekend into the week. But you know, we're all, you know, working class lads. Of course, we got carried away. We did what we were meant to do. We nearly ruined it, but we just about managed to kind of keep the thing going. And yeah, God bless Fabric for. I can't go into some of the stories that are now rattling around my head, but I've definitely overstepped the mark with the security guards and stuff there. So I'm glad I never got kicked to death as I deserve to be.
You want to leave that there?
I will leave it there.
Back into the box for another question. Say when.
When?
Are you helped or hindered by technology?
Right. Yeah, definitely helped. Definitely, definitely helped. I mean, the fact that you can have X amount of thousands of tracks in your laptop, they invented that time-coded vinyl thing with Serato, and now you've got Phase. All of these things are fantastic. I mean, they totally help, because I can go and play a club and have an enormous library of music at my fingertips. and can travel without having to worry about a record bag. I mean, that was a big deal. You'd have to carry this enormous thing to all these different countries. And obviously, I mean, yeah, we were diggers as well. So I think the first time we went to Australia, I ended up buying so many records that I spent my wages on the bags going back, because it was like 1,600 quid to fly these enormous heavy bags home.
So you'd be a very rich man if it weren't for the records. Yeah.
Damn you, records, yes. But no, it definitely helped. I mean, even though the studio's filled with really old vintage equipment, I still love the fact that I can record it into, you know, a modern computer and be able to edit things together and stuff. But the actual creation of stuff, I really feel more at home with old bits of equipment.
Back into the box for your third question. Say when. Okay. Wow. What's the greatest stage you've ever played?
Oh my God. There's two. I mean, it's a stupid thing to say, but there is two. There's too many. It's just been so many wonderful stages. But there have. I mean, it's almost impossible not to kind of hark back to that period of time of playing Fabric, because we, you know, it felt like we lived there. It is such an institution. And I think we were just incredibly fortunate to play there for that amount of time with that style of music, with such a high turnover of things happening, that I would say that stage in Room 1 is the greatest spot that I've played.
You talked about Glastonbury earlier. What about festival stages other than Glastonbury?
Oh, I mean, festival work has always been a really important aspect of gigging, that kind of whole season in the summer. And I feel quite fortunate to be on the bill with some incredible people. I mean, Shindig was amazing. I got to share the stage with a guy called Scratch Bastard, who's an amazing DJ from Canada. And also did like Elusive Festival, which was mad, and Boomtown. And I think there's quite a lot in the pipeline for 2024.
So things are in great shape.
Yeah, yeah, things are really, really good.
Cool. Pleased to hear it. Two more questions from the box. Let me dip in again.
When?
What do you wish you'd never done?
I'm not really one for regrets. I just... There's never been, trying to answer this question. It's a tricky one, because I genuinely don't regret anything. I don't feel like there's not something I can kind of point and think, if only I'd, you know.
If not a regret, then what about an embarrassing moment?
I was once judging a DJ competition at the Ministry of Sound, and we all got really drunk, and one of the other judges started physically touching a girl that was looking after us, bringing us drinks. And I asked him to stop, and he hurled abuse at me. So I hit him and then was immediately escorted out of the club by the black bouncers and got quite badly injured in the process. So that's maybe an embarrassing moment for me.
For doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Have you ever embarrassed yourself in front of other DJs, like working with them?
Oh yeah, constantly. I mean, you're constantly making mistakes or you know, mucking up mixes or whatnot. But that's just part of the game, isn't it?
Who's your DJ king or queen?
I really like Sherelle. I think seeing her kind of meteoric rise and the music that she champions, I think, is fantastic. And seeing, you know, a vehicle of something like Boiler Room really being used to the maximum effect and for all the right reasons, the right person really spearheading and just, you know, blowing up. I think that's fantastic. No hype, no nonsense, just someone who's incredibly skillful, incredibly good and playing, you know, the best music. And King, I'd have to say D-Styles, who's like a really incredible scratch DJ. Very kind of low-key dude, but very enjoyable. It was always tinged with a bit of heartache watching him cut, because he's so good. And you kind of watch him thinking, I could live 10 lifetimes and I'll never get as good as this fella. Very, very natural scratcher and all-round cool dude.
One more question for you. So say when?
When?
Who is the greatest DJ to ever live? You've kind of just answered this, but...
Well, he's, I mean, the thing is, D-Styles, he's a scratch DJ. He's not like a DJ DJ.
What about, let me reframe that question. What about a DJ, when you've had the best time on the dance for yourself?
This would hark back to sort of my days when I was going out raving with my friends, and we would be regulars, things that Norman would do, and we'd be regulars at the Blue Note and a place called the Iceni on Whitehorse Lane in Mayfair. That was like a spot where, but again, it wasn't like you were there to see a particular DJ. You were just there for the vibe. So you weren't really following a particular person. It would just be, there'd be a group of people on the lineup and you knew you'd have a great time. But yeah, I mean, Norman's like an institution and a selector, incredible selector. So I say Norman.
Norman J.
Yeah.
Yeah, good shout. One last question. It's the end of the world and you've got to play the last three records on earth. What would they be?
Killing in the Name Of. The Final Countdown. It's the Final
Countdown. Yeah, all right. Yeah, 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 yeah. Into
Crosstown Traffic.
Awesome.
Jimi Hendrix. Yeah. Yeah, maybe missed the middle one out. I was joking.
Quite the mix. And if anyone could, you could. Joel, thanks so much, mate.
Oh, thank you.
Brilliant. And that was How to DJ.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow us wherever you get your podcast from.